Microscope is a role-playing game in which you explore an epic history of your own creation, build beautiful jewels of civilization, then consume them with nuclear fire. Zoom out to watch the majestic tide of history wash across empires, then zoom in and explore the lives of the people who endured it. I'm Epistory Richard, co-organizer of the London Indie RPG Meetup Group.
My name is Robert Cannell, and I'm an RPG zine editor and non-award-winning game designer. Microscope is obviously a seminal early game. Why is it so significant?
I got into indie RPGs and story games in order to find a way for people to collaborate effectively with the creation, not just of a single adventure, but with a creation of a whole background. And Microscope, this is what it offered me. But more than just why it's personally notable to me, is it's a game that I think, at least as far as I'm aware, was unlike any game that came before it. I mean, obviously, it's popular. It's one of the most popular games that we run at conventions and the like. It's really easy to explain. It's really easy to get lots of different people involved. And there's a really strong visual element to it to hook people in. But beyond both the fact that it appears to be so innovative and it's also got that draw, beyond that, it's also a game that does more than being just a game. It's more than saying, you can sit down and play this for 4 hours and have a good time with it. It's also one that says that you can use this game as a tool to help you in your other games. So one of the ways that you can use Microscope is saying, right, I want to run a Dungeon World campaign or a Pathfinder campaign, but I don't want the GM to go off and like create it on their own. I want everybody to have a bit of it, and they can do it by using a game of Microscope in order to create the whole game. I mean, that for me is why I'm really passionate about talking about it.
Yeah, I'd agree. Coming from a more traditional role-playing background, I think Microscope is the first game to really deliver on that promise of being able to collaborate on a massive swathe of history that you can then subsequently play games inside. I mean, lots of games try to do that by simulation, effectively. You know, things like Greyhawk Wars, which was more or less a board war game that allowed you to play out a fictional piece of history in the game to make the world yours, but obviously at the end of the day was quite a complicated board war game, and Microscope by comparison is very easy to get into and applies across a lot more styles. You're not kind of getting into simulating the particular aspects of the genre of the world, so that's quite interesting. And I think it's still probably quite unique in that space. There's slightly more,
and this effort, is something,
but nothing as comprehensive.
This is something that is we'll get on to talk about later when we talk about the legacy of it. It's almost a game that came in and was so good at what it was trying to do that nobody else bothered to try and duplicate it. So from my perspective, I realise that I don't have a huge amount of history with indie RPGs, but this was a game that came along and just appeared to come out of nowhere. So it didn't appear to me to have any forebears. There was no. Quite often, when you read a new game, is that you can see, oh, they've taken a little bit from that or a little bit from that, and then they made it their own. But in this case, it all came in and it was like completely fresh.
I would have to agree. I can't really think of any precedents for this. Not in terms of the idea of the visual layout of the history, not really in terms of the idea of, which we'll probably have to talk about in more depth, about kind of getting away from individuals and moving to themes.
So understood, I think, the goal, the intent behind the design, but what is there actually in the game in order to accomplish that?
It's a very tight design. I think Ben Robbins is one of the really great game designers, and it feels to me like Microscope has very little fat on it. So, like, let's just start off with the first thing you do, which is like define the start and the end.
Of the
situation.
I think we might have a bit of a disagreement coming up, but carry on.
Okay, good. So you know, the very framing mechanism where you say the story starts with this and ends with this, and these are the boundaries.
Absolutely agree.
And the idea that those boundaries are very much, you know, they're very much larger than the scope of any game would normally be. You know, it can be the first stars appear, you know, it's thousands of years of history. It's that kind of big, bold statement right from the start. And then once you're into the game, there's some subtle things where people are allowed to kind of get something they're interested in and retain that. So when it's their go, you know, when the performing
the lens,
they get to add more to the game, but it is themed around a topic, and also they get to set the agenda for the rest of the goes.
And that, as the name of the lens would suggest, that actually provides a bit more focus.
Exactly.
And that's what it's called, the focus.
Yes, exactly.
Is it so that it's not just kind of a hodgepodge of things that get thrown in there each time, is that you are trying to theme each turn, each round.
Yeah, and the player is given permission to pursue what they find interesting.
And what you find is that the things that will get added to the game, perhaps early on, that people don't know how to engage with, or people don't find particularly inspiring because it's left there on the table, is something that they often ends up coming back, is that people then go, okay, we're really interested in developing this particular part of the timeline, but okay, well, now we're going to go back and we're going to build out that mysterious thing that nobody was really inspired by at the time, and we're going to work out how it all connects together.
And the flip side of lensing is legacies, which is where a player can choose to pluck out of the round the thing that they felt was interesting, and again it gives them permission to come back and review that, kind of investigate it in more depth later. One thing that strikes me about Microscope Mechanics is that there is a subtle emphasis on the player telling the other players what they think is interesting, from the lens declaring the focus, to the legacies being retained, to the questions that people ask during the game. So questions are a mechanical thing. There's not many if you think of the game as being made up of moves, there's very few passive moves. In playing the game, you tell the other players what you're interested in.
Yep.
That's probably the most powerful driver, because it's impossible to do that anti kind of game thing of like holding on to your ideas.
Being defensive.
Yes.
Playing defensively.
Or, trying to get the game to go in a particular direction. Microscope has these three different levels of concept of depth. The kind of the large spans of time,
the epochs
almost. Yeah. And then the discrete events, what happened within that time. And then the
scenes beneath it.
Yes, which are scenes are only ever played to resolve questions that players have wanted to answer. If other players have engaged with the concept that you are mutually interested in, the level of depth around that topic is just naturally greater.
I mean, from my perspective, I think the different layers of detail are vitally important to it, sort of the different scale. So, and the designer sums it up by saying that when people relate stories to other people, not in the sense of like a movie or something like that, is that they will, but something that has actually happened to them or a period of history, they will start off with a broad overview and then a big summary, and then they will go into more and more granular detail, more and more, and they will zoom in. I think the name Microscope is really apposite in that sense, of because it is, you're zooming in and you're zooming out all the time, and when you look at it, you have a big summary at the beginning. So having that, being able to summarize it all with the periods, and then being able to summarize each period with the events, and then being able to drill down into the events of the period, I think that is obviously the core mechanic in which is accomplishing this ability to explore this big history. I want to go back to something you said right at the beginning about defining the start and the end of the big beginning. That's a really important step, because the temptation, I think, when you're creating something like this one is to do it chronologically. Or if you've decided that you've taken the jump and you say, okay, we're not going to be chronological, is then to start with like a single event and work outward from there. Is that instead he says, like, we're going to basically, in this game, which is so free-roaming, where you can create so much, he said, we're actually going to put some limitations on it right at the beginning. This is where you start, and this is where you stop. And that just helps.
And they're the limits that drive creativity. They're the classic example of the boundaries that mean that it goes from everything being open to suddenly the group homing in and starting to build the consensus.
So I think those, the bookends you put in are really important about inspiring creativity through constraint. And the other big component that accomplishes this ability to build these big worlds is this elasticity of the chronology. Is that, and that's kind of implicit within the periods and the events and the scenes, but he made the decision to say, I do not want to go from A to B to C to D in creation, which is the natural thing to do, is that you are creating a history. So you create a particular event or things happening or people or nations, and you go, okay, what happens to them next? What happens to them next? What happens to them next? And what happens, and the problems that it causes, is that where you have this kind of collaboration, is that things go in wildly different directions to the way that were perhaps intended, that perhaps anybody wants to attend. And the example he gives in the book is someone creates the city of Atlantis, and then the next turn someone nukes the city of Atlantis, and then everybody else has to deal with the radioactive remains of the city that they thought they were going to be playing around in. And so whereas other games build...
So to be clear, the reason how Microscope solves that allows you to zoom back. It doesn't matter that someone nukes Atlantis, because you can spend as much time as you like before Atlantis is nuked.
Yeah.
Because you can infill...
So the way other games deal with it is by putting in, saying, okay, if something happens you don't like, have a discussion about it. Or they'll put in ritual phrases to say, or they'll say, you know, you can challenge these particular things. But the way Microscope does it, it says, no, people's contribution is sacrosanct. But you get to extend the timeline between the point that you created the city and the point it got nuked as much as you like. So if your first thing you do in the game is you create Atlantis is built, the second thing that gets done in the game is Atlantis is destroyed, you can still play the rest of the entire game, like within between those two time periods, just by stretching it out.
Yeah.
And I think that the different layers of detail, that concept of elasticity, the chronology, are the two kind of integral parts, the integral mechanics that make it the ability not only to build an epic history, but also to explore it.
So both of us seem to have like all kinds of praise for the mechanics and the structure of the game.
So, I mean, I think this game, in terms of its goal, succeeds completely. Is it, its design goal is to build and explore epic history, and it does that, and it does more than that, because you can use the same principle in order to explore a single life or a single moment or like the lifespan of an organization. It doesn't have to be an epic history. It works irrespective of the kind of the scale that you're using at. But so something that has become apparent from more apparent in the designers' later work is that they have developed this game, they've designed this game to solve all the problems that you may encounter during this game. So the game is very well designed, but it's one that in the huge amount of playtesting it's had is that the designer has seen problems occur, I'm guessing maybe only a handful of times, but he's thought, no, I want to resolve this. I want to give everybody a mechanic in order to be able to resolve this particular problem, even though it really doesn't come up. And it may never come up in your own games, but nevertheless, it kind of weighs the game down just a little bit.
Can you give me a specific example? Because that's a big statement.
Anything in the scene in the chapter on scenes which begin with where the heading begins with the word push. Right? Okay, because there are several pages there devoted to dealing with creative conflicts that you may encounter during a scene, and it uses this concept of the push, where you are looking to basically push your creative idea upon somebody else, either onto their character, or you're trying to contradict something that they've already done. And there is a mechanism in there. So if this ever happens, there is a mechanism in which you can resolve it. Is that you put forward your proposal, other people put forward their proposal, there's a voting system, right? And then you proceed with whatever got the most of the votes. And it's quite a nice voting system as well. But still, it's one that, and I have no problem with that as a form of creative resolution, but it has never, ever happened to me. And I played this game it's probably my second most played game of, like, after Monster Hearts. And I've never had the problem where we haven't been able to work through a scene and the players have been so either aggressive or stubborn in being able to work together. And so having those kind of rules in there give me the kind of the comfort that, yes, he has playtested this extensively and he knows all the things can go wrong with it, but also it means that there's just this tiny little bit of added weight. It just goes into a bit too much detail for me.
Appendix.
Optional rule. Embrace the concept of optionally you may choose to do this if you really need to.
Yeah.
The other point I'd mention about it is that the the game calls itself saying, this is a role-playing game in which you explore an epic history. And if pushed, you could say that there was a small bit of role-playing in it. At a very small level. And this is a challenge that people coming from different backgrounds, yeah, also, like, especially people coming from a more traditional role-playing background, mm-hmm, struggle with, in that,
yeah,
there is so little role-playing within it. It is basically a conversation through, mm, about a history that you do through the game. And
I'm quite interested in this point as well, because, like, I'm probably played the game similarly to you, in like I kind of like push through the scene. And some games say, when you're kind of in this scene setting thing, is like, we don't have to rush, take time, explore it, describe it, talk about what your character's feeling. And when you're demoing,
you mean in other games?
Yes, in other games.
Yeah.
There's a temptation to push the scene to the king, because the scene is always framed in terms of the question that's being wanting, yeah, to be answered, right? So there's always an explicit frame and exploration. I quite often feel like, to make it more exciting, I'm always pushing and rushing towards answering that question. Mm. But I think there is an alternative way of playing it, mm, which is to take time and enjoy these scenes. And maybe if you were playing multiple sessions of it, you might enjoy, you know, like maybe 15 minutes, mm, of role playing, where you more kind of get into the characters and explore what they think.
That's a really fair point. And because when I've talked to other people about playing it, I have heard of people playing it very differently. Whereas the games that I play tend to mainly dwell periods and events, or like, mm, we'll have like half a dozen periods that will come out relatively early, mm, and then it will mainly be about exploring events, and there will be some scenes under them. Mm. Is that other people that I've spoken to have said, yeah, we get our periods out, but really we spend an awful lot of time on the scene. So again, that's something that, and I think framing the scenes around a question is a really great, I'm not sure if this is the first time that somebody said, play the scene until you've answered the question, mm, but it certainly fits in very well with his design methodology. You are doing this, but only for a limited time.
Yeah.
You're not building periods and events, mm, until you find a scene, yeah, in order to kick off your next 2 hours of role playing.
Yes.
Is that once you've answered it, you stop. And then if you, mm, want to carry on doing it, it's somebody else has to break, yeah, a scene, yeah, around it.
A lot of free-form role-playing games, that is what a lot of people complain about. Is they get into a scene and they don't know how to frame it, and they, yeah, don't know how to drive it. And again, because someone goes into a scene, you know, like a lot of these mechanics are about declaring intent. Mm. And you go into a scene declaring intent, so you kind of get, yeah, what you're meant to do.
And going back to the venerable, 2009 fiasco, is that people talk about jumping over that gap between the setup and the,
yeah,
scenes,
yeah,
and like when you're actually playing the game, and people getting into there like, oh, we have all this great backstory, but we don't know what to do with, yeah, it in order to then enjoy actually playing with it in, mm, scene. So having, mm, framing the question, a really, really useful way, yeah, of providing a purpose, yeah, without predetermining how it's going, yeah, to end.
I would say mechanically that's a really interesting comparison, right? Because for me, Microscope is really well designed because it is constantly driving and framing those things. And in Fiasco, it's really good fun, and you generate loads of stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You mean
with no point to any of it. You know, there is absolutely nothing at the end of it. It's like filled with wacky characters and chickens shoved full of cocaine or whatever. And no idea what you're meant to do.
I think I played that by myself. We've talked a lot about how well designed we feel it is, but fundamentally, so is it a game that you play for joy, or is it a game that you play because it provides some other kind of worthwhile experience?
Now, I think the interesting thing, and I'd be interested to hear your opinion on this, for me, Microscope takes so much player input to create its game. I've got tired of playing it multiple times, but each time it was enjoyable, and it was a pleasurable experience, because you feel like you have a tremendous amount of input into the game, and there are, you know, the feedback loops we talked about building on one another's contribution. For me, always, you know, like, they're always interesting, memorable storylines, and there's little funny bits, mm, that kind of stick out to you, even out the random pickup games.
Mm.
And I think it's because you throw some stuff out there, some people build on it, you build on it, and it always feels like this collaborative story that everyone who played owned, you, mm, know? And I think it's just really consistent for me in delivering that experience.
I actually have a small admission to make here. As much as I have talked about how Microscope is the game that I got into story games to find, and as much as I have spent half an hour talking about how much I love Microscope on this and on other podcasts, I've never actually had an awesome game of Microscope.
Wow.
I've never finished a game of Microscope and gone, that was amazing! That was awesome! As I have done with coming away from other games that I've played. On the flip side, I've never had a bad game of Microscope. I've never had a game of Microscope where it's been unutterably dull and I've been bored out of my brain and other people's contributions to it are uninspiring or something like that. Is that no matter who you bring to the table, they bring different things and they bring things that I find inspiring. That being said, it doesn't hit the same emotional, doesn't get the same emotional reaction that I've had playing games that, dare I say it, are more immersive. So what I get out of it is the overall creation. I think Microscope is one of those games that has, because of its design choice, because of its main mechanic, has this wonderful benefit to it that when you have finished playing the game, you can stack it all up like in a particular order, which is laid out, which is obvious, but is laid out in the book as well. And that is your entire game.
It's quite amazing, the self-recording nature of the game.
Yeah, and I think that's a really real benefit and a real boon to new players coming into it, because it not only does it allow for the new people to cycle in, so you can have a game, and I've done this, and have a game which is being played all day, and you have some players who stick with it for an hour, other players who just come in and make one contribution, but they can all join in and get up to speed just by looking at everything. As soon as you explain how periods and events work, they can they can engage with it. So it's a wonderful game, a wonderful way for pickup games. The one point I will also make, and it's a point that, that obviously the designer identified and he mentions in his notes, is the creative hot seat is not always a pleasant place to be in. And that is the one bit of in terms of the dynamic of going around the table where I completely understand why it's done that way, and I completely agree with how it's been designed, but it is just an inherent part that where you have somebody who feels more restricted, who feels more uncomfortable putting themselves forward, and they are in a position where it's their turn and they have to contribute something, and they're not allowed to go around and get other people's opinions about it, and everybody is waiting for them to do it, that is an uncomfortable moment. But it's really, really important almost to have those uncomfortable moments in order that they know that next time it comes around is that they will be more ready, or they'll be more willing to know that they can create something without it destroying the game, because the game is built to be so robust that nobody can destroy it. And the great side effect of all that is that where you have players who actually are creative but just don't get a huge amount of what I call like the bandwidth of the game, because I mean, for example, with this day-long game we had I remember at one point I had a couple of teenage boys, I had another kind of experienced player, and then I had a dad and his son, and his son was about 10 years old. The best ideas came out of the 10-year-old son. And it was somebody who, in any other game that we were playing, maybe would not have said anything because he was reticent about putting himself forward. But there, because everybody knew it was his turn and he had to contribute something, he contributed stuff, and it was great, and it helped power the rest of the game.
So, it is both good and bad.
There are unfortunate, inevitable consequence to the
putting people on the spot.
But it's overall beneficial.
Yeah. Because I guess what I'd say about it is that it feels like it came out of the blue sky. Feels like it was after 2 years of hard work. It was like an instant success, and it feels like so complete and perfect as a game that I almost think like not only is there nothing been really before it, but I don't think there's really been anything after it either. I mean, what is the legacy of Microscope except people playing Microscope?
And somebody coming along saying, yes, you can take a completely different take on it. We can play a game, and this thing that we always thought was completely set, we can play around with that as well. The way that he gets around the use of having to not having things like a do it differently phrase or let's have a discussion or an alarm kind of thing in it, so that people are able to create without feeling they're going to break the game, is, again, an awfully powerful thing that I think should be taken forward, that people should be thinking about. How can we allow people to create without destroying what other people are trying to do?
That concept of elasticity that you described.
Where is
the elasticity of the stories we're telling, or is it essentially always driving?
Because fundamentally, and that is something, fundamentally is something that can be done in a more regular role-playing game. We've always been comfortable with the idea of flashbacks and stuff like that, and people would do it. But it's never been so built into a game, or it's never such so clearly an option that people can actually say, actually, I don't mind that my character just got killed in the first scene, because the game gives me enough tools in order to have a satisfying game about my character for the remaining 3 hours. There's no game that's done that, but I think it's something that could be done. I think kicking off a scene by framing a question is a great, and that has certainly been taken up by I'm not sure if this was the first game to do it, but it's certainly something that's been taken up by subsequent games.
I think probably more generalised into techniques of freeform role-playing as well.
The concept of a palette.
Right? Yes.
Which we've not mentioned so far, and we really should, as a way to drive tone. So instead of saying, well, we're all going for like some kind of gritty crime drama, you can actually spell it out exactly what that kind of thing means to you. So I really want like a hard-nosed gangster, and I really want a kind of a devious mole. But equally, I don't want corrupt law enforcement officers for whatever reason. And I think the overall thing which I think is should be part of its legacy is how it encourages players to collaborate through the game, through the game's mechanics. Rather than having them all step out of the game and then having to, in order to discuss where the story is going. I completely take your point of it was this kind of beautiful thing, perfect cloud that appeared in a blue sky, but has not, but doesn't appear to have influenced other things after it, because it just completely, it was the tool that we needed in order to do that thing. But I think there are several aspects to it, whether or not they were the first things. They were first included in there, but should be considered by game designers going forwards.
I totally agree with that.
And so, from my perspective, Microscope is absolutely part of the canon. It should be a game which is read and understood by kind of game designers who are looking to create, and it should be part of our kind of lingua franca as in game design. But what do you think?
Well, so at the start of this conversation, my view was actually that wasn't the case, that there wasn't anything. It's kind of hard to explain. I felt it was kind of like an exception. It wasn't part of a continuum of design, and therefore it was kind of like a freakish, beautiful, lovely thing.
No one is out there designing Microscope 2.
But I think over the course of this discussion, like, I have changed my mind, because you're right, there are things about statement intent, about framing, about the palette, about saying what you want from a game, that are clearly things that designers are still not getting right. And there's a powerful example of how you can do it, and how you can get your mechanics to reinforce what you intend. So I'm preparing to do like a searing U-turn, and I guess the difference is, as a designer, if you don't understand the power of the system, you're missing out, because you're failing to see a way that you can do what you probably would like to do yourself in your own games.
Yeah.
As a player, must you play Microscope?
I've never had an awesome game of Microscope, but I would still say, as a player, you are missing out if you've never played Microscope. Simply because it is more than just a game. It is also a tool. So that even if you only play it once and go, you know, I really didn't care for this being it, this being all to the game. At least, you know, when you then go back and go, okay, we want to create a new, like, star empire in order to, for our rogues and mercenaries and everything like that, in order to adventure in, we can go, well, you know, our regular GM, like, he doesn't want to do it, he's short on time. Well, how about we use this? In order to then create it ourselves and get the whole group inspired about it.
Yeah, I think fundamentally that is the big thing, you know, for me as well. The shared creation, the shared involvement, and the sense that everyone in the group owns the story that comes out of it.
So Microscope is a game that came almost perfect, fully formed on its release. So of course we understand the amount of playtesting that went into it.
but is one that's almost been so perfect that hasn't had a huge number of successors who are building up off the DNA within that game. Another game, a lot like that, and one that, to be honest, it is a crime that we aren't talking about this time around, is Fiasco. So Fiasco, possibly the best-known indie RPG out there, certainly one of the ones with the highest profile, that developed by Jason Morningstar, who had written kind of several games before it, but fundamentally it got released. It was brilliant.
You say brilliant, but did you perhaps mean boring at that point?
Let me check. B-R-I-L-L-I-A-N-T. No, I think that spells brilliant.
In my view, Fiasco is a flawed game and it's difficult to get through. But I'm willing to go through that boredom so I can prove to you what is wrong with this game.